Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. Today is March 3rd, 2015. We appreciate everyone's patience as we were waiting for the House and the Senate to grab a little bit of lunch and come join us. So on the agenda today are three items, and we'll start off, we're going to follow the agenda, and we'll start off with the first item, and we're going to open up a public hearing on a request to apply for a federal grant. It looks like the governor's office is going to be bringing this forward. Darren, what do we need to know on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the governor's office is here. They're kind of coordinating this. They'll come and talk to you about it. It's a request for a grant for the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development for the HUD National Disaster Resilience Competition.
Perfect. All righty. Why don't we invite up Heidi, Alice, and if I mispronounce this, please correct me. You may. Am I close? All right, come on up if you'd introduce yourselves for the record. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm Heidi Moat.
I'm Alice Vivel, state architect with DAS.
I'm Yume Wong, engineer with DAS.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, Brian DeForest with the Chief Finance Office.
Perfect, welcome.
Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, and Smith, and members of the committee, thank you for giving us this opportunity to speak with you about this resilience competition. I'm Governor Brown's Public Safety Policy Advisor, and Alice and Yume are here today to help answer any specific questions you may have about the grant. They've been doing all of the real work associated with it and are definitely the subject matter experts. I do also feel that we have to quickly thank the agencies that have been working on this grant so far, in addition to DAS, OEM, OBDD, ODOT, and DICD have all committed a lot of state resources to work on this. And in addition to that, Sweat Equity, the five state agencies, including the governor's office, combined resources to come up with $50,000 for a grant advisor that we procured using the RFP process. As you are aware from our letter submitted early last month, the competition will reward up to $1 billion nationally to eligible localities. The threshold for eligibility is quite stringent, and many of our communities did not qualify. But through a series of meetings and listening tours, Ms. Vivel and Ms. Wong, with the assistance of those state agencies I mentioned, identified two towns that meet the threshold conditions, and that's Reedsport and Brookings. And they can be included in the Phase 1 application. My letter that we submitted indicates we believed we could get between $5 to $15 million for those communities. However, as we continue to meet and talk with Rockefeller and our advisor, we now believe that the target number could be as much as $10 to $20 million for those communities. And this brings up an important point, which is this is the first HUD CDBG grant of its kind.
Question here, Sorry. Senator Johnson.
Collectively, the two communities or each community?
Collectively.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson, sorry. This brings up an important point. This is the first HUD CDBG grant of its kind, so it's quite unique, and I would say it's a bit of an experiment on their part. Instead of focusing just on throwing money at disaster recovery, this shifts the paradigm to planning and building for resilience. The state has been analyzing and planning for impacts of extreme weather, the Cascadia earthquake, and tsunami for some time, and this is an opportunity to actually execute projects for these vulnerable communities. Since there is no precedent, we don't really know how we will fare, though. All that being said, we do believe our Phase 1 application will result in an invitation to participate in Phase 2. Our solution, the Regional Solutions Rural Incubator Process, would deliver big science and big capacity to these small at-risk communities. And we believe that it has the potential to be a national model in building resilience. So we ask today for your permission to submit the Phase 1 application and, if we are invited, to submit the Phase 2. I do have to tell you that we believe Phase 2 will cost more money. We may need a little help with money for the grant advisor, which would be probably about another $50,000, and potentially for more resources to add to whichever agency we assigned this project to for phase two, as we have used up all of our sweat equity at DAS on phase one. So there is still a lot of work to be done, but we do believe it is good, important work, and we hope to have your support. And we can answer any questions.
Senator Johnson.
Well, it should probably come as no surprise when I tell you how exquisitely disappointed I am. This has been an issue that we have kicked around on the coast, and I'm not going to get in the way of Reedsport or Brookings, but this is something that we talked about on the coast. I was out soliciting from private grant sources enough money to let Tillamook County participate. I think Tillamook was one of the first counties that came to you and pointed out the grant and began cobbling together the opportunity for multi-county cooperation. When we talk about how vulnerable Reedsport and Brookings are, I can list you school after school that coastal representatives and senators have in the inundation zone. I'm sorry I was a little bit late and missed your explanation about what distinguishes Reedsport and Brookings from other coastal communities, and why it is that they're now in the queue for projects and others are abandoned and left behind. I feel kind of betrayed by this whole thing, to be truthful with you, and I just don't know what happened on the way to the dais here when it was other parts of the coast that first lifted this up for consideration.
Senator Johnson and co-chairs, I'm going to let the subject matter experts explain a little bit more about the threshold eligibility, but suffice it to say that Tillamook was one of the locations that they had a listening tour, and after hearing what the thresholds were, Commissioner Labhart, who you and I have talked to about this extensively, Senator, Commissioner Labhart withdrew Tillamook County from consideration and said that he did not believe that Tillamook County met HUD's very high threshold. I mean, it's not that we chose not to include Tillamook, it's that they do not meet the threshold.
Follow? I don't know whether or not the listening sessions were sent out to legislators so that we had the option to participate. I don't know when they were held. I don't know if my coastal colleagues were informed. I'm dying to hear from the subject matter experts about what are the distinguishing characteristics of these two communities. And again, I am going to support this because any of this federal largesse to cause our communities to be more resilient is in our coastal best interest and in our Oregon best interest. But I sure am disappointed.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the question is probably a little premature, but I would hope that as you discuss this, you will let us know in some detail what resiliency planning means and what rigorous HUD requirements are. I mean, are we, you know, I can visualize a rebuilding wonderful thing, or I can visualize a social planning thing. So I'd like to have a little more clarity. Oh, and the other question is, this is Senator Cruz and Representative Krieger's area. Have they been in the loop on this?
Yes, they have. Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt and Senator Johnson, to address those questions, resiliency is really about being able to take a big hit and recover quickly. So whether that big hit is a Cascadia earthquake or some other type of shock, it's for communities to be able to have enough capacity to recover and recover better than when they were before they were hit. As far as why more communities aren't part of this application, it's because HUD really has a very, very narrow eligibility criteria door to get through. And although we look throughout the...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. What's that mean?
Yeah. So HUD is using leftover Katrina and Sandy money and distributing it to 67 eligible entities, and the state of Oregon is one of those. And for communities to be eligible, they have to have had a certain amount of damage from one presidentially declared disasters that occurred in Oregon in 2011 and 2012. We had three presidential disasters, one in January 2011, which was a storm event, one in March 2011, which was a tsunami event from Japan that hit the Brookings Harbor, and the third is a winter storm in January 2012. So although we try to determine other communities that are eligible, for instance, Mount Hood Village was one of the earlier communities we thought that would make it through the narrow threshold criteria. They have to have at least $2 million of infrastructure damage or a certain number of homes, like 100 homes that have been flooded, and other criteria such as a certain percentage of low moderate income citizens or households, certain amount of unemployment rate, and they have to show a certain amount of unmet need. And there's a lot of details to all of this. The only two communities that ended up here standing at the end are Brookings and Reedsport.
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, if I could just add, we also worked with Seaside for quite a long time until at the very end we found that we weren't able to meet the threshold conditions. The grant is actually set up largely around housing to do housing and address issues of blight in those kind of communities. So the structure of the grant is really a leap beyond what is typically permitted for community development block grants. So they use the chassis of this, but to address much larger issues. But we still needed to meet that community development block grant criteria, which is, you may just mentioned, is really very narrow, very prescriptive. And on the whole, rural communities do not qualify for them. It's primarily focused around urban communities. And I think that in Oregon, and it was largely because of the excellent data that we had from OEM, from OBDD, from the communities themselves, and all of the, frankly, footwork they did, which was substantial, that we were even able to make it with those two communities. In our discussions with our peers around the country, very few rural communities are even applying for this grant.
So give us an example, should we be successful, of what projects might look like.
Sure. So in the case of Reedsport, this is, and I think everyone here knows the city, but it's a city that's on the confluence of three rivers. It has a levee around it. The downtown was built in a wetland area, and it has a levee around it. But the levee is having difficulties, and there's water that is coming down from the watershed and getting trapped behind the levee. So they have continuous flooding problems. So one example of a project might be addressing the levee issues, the certification of the levee, perhaps increasing the height of the levee, looking at the different retention and pumping strategies, addressing the housing and some of the businesses that have had damage over time. So that it's that kind of work, and work around roadways, making them stable, that have been damaged by repeated
Thank you, Senator
problems.
Johnson.
Thank you.
I just can't let this pass without being crabby about it. Tillamook County has had 12 presidentially declared disasters with multiple millions of dollars of loss in both property, real property, real estate, and drowned animals, to be really blunt about it. This narrow window to conform with the Katrina and Sandy money, I just think is just obscenely short-sighted. The other thing is that all around this state, we are scrambling for money for levies. The previous governor put $7 million in his budget. The need is so dramatic. I'm talking about the levies that protect PDX and all the industrial out there. So if somehow we say the levees that are protecting Brookings and Reedsport are unique in some way, I would submit to you that practically all of Northwest Oregon and practically all of the coast is behind some kind of water management device. And to simply limit this kind of federal intervention in a problem they helped create, the Dyson levees are a problem they helped create, and to limit it now to this little tiny window is like putting a Band-Aid on a slit throat. I know it's not your fault, but it just contravenes common sense.
Yep. Senator, we agree with you.
All righty. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Could you explain in a little more detail what role the Rockefeller Foundation has in helping to distribute federal tax money?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, they do not have a role in distributing monies. They have an advisory role to HUD. It's a technical advisory role to help educate the applicants about the nature and the requirements of the application. So they do not have a role in evaluating the submissions or allocating the funds. That is not their role. It is a technical role for the applicants in preparing their submission.
Thank you.
All right. Any other comments you folks want to share? Thank you for coming up. Do we have anyone in the public that's here to testify? We are in a public hearing on behalf of this grant request. No? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on this federal grant request, and we're going to open up a work session on this federal grant request. Darren.
Sure. Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approving the request with the understanding that if the grant is awarded, the agency will return to the legislature to provide an update on the plan for state staffing and resources that will be needed as soon as they are available.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to approve the submission of a federal grant to the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development for the HUD National Disaster Resilience Competition.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. And with a recommendation, if you want to do that.
Yes,
or that,
and I would, in asking for this approval, I would also like to add, Mr. Chair.
And my computer turned off. There we go.
I would like to add that this is under the understanding that if the grant is awarded, the agency will return to the legislature to provide an update on the plan for state staffing and resources that will be needed as soon as that's available. And this is consistent with the LFO recommendation.
Perfect. So we have a motion. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so approved. All righty. Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, I'm going to ask you to carry this one.
Sure.
Is that all right?
Absolutely, whatever you prefer.
Sir. Okay.
And so I should be ready to make a motion.
Yeah. Well, you'll be ready for motion on the next one.
Yes.
Okay. I think we'll go on the next motion.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No,
we're getting the computer going.
Yeah, they were trying to get malware onto my computer, and I decided I better not let that happen.
All right, so now we've closed that work session. We have a carrier. We're now going to open up a public hearing on a federal grant request from the state library. John, what do we need to know on this?
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. The state library is before you for a request for permission to apply for a federal grant for the National Endowment of the Humanities for a preservation assistance grant for small institutions.
All righty. And so we have Mary Kay and Lisa. I'm going to ask you folks to come on up. And if you could share with us a little bit about what we're looking at here.
Good
Co-chairs, members of the committee, this grant request comes from our Government Services and Government Information and Library Services Division. As you know, we have quite a vast number of Oregon documents dating back a number of years. A lot of those are put in what are called substandard enclosures, which means they're acidic. And what we're looking for with this $6,000 grant is to purchase materials that would allow us to preserve those materials.
Perfect. All righty. Any questions for Mary Kay? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Mary Kay. Do we have anyone in the public that would like to testify during this public hearing on this grant request? Going once, going twice. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on this federal grant request, and we're going to open up a work session on this federal grant request. John.
LFO recommends approval of the request.
Perfect. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we approve the request from the State Library for this grant. Submitted to Full Ways and Means.
Perfect. All right. So we have a motion on the table that we approve this federal grant request. Are there any questions or comments? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none. So approved. All right. We need a carrier on this one. Representative Nathanson, would you carry this?
I have like a big L.
You have the library. All right, so, Representative Nathanson.
I would carry the.
Representative Comp, would you do that?
I'd love to.
All right, would that be all right? Well, Representative Comp, we're going to ask you to carry this. All right, we're going to close the work session then on this federal grant. We're now going to move to the public hearing on Senate Bill 5519. So I'm going to open up that. And Mary Kay and Lisa, you're back up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. Co-chairs, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Mary Kay Dahlgreen. I'm the state librarian. I'm really excited to talk to you today about the strategic plan and some of the changes that we've made at the state library. So I wanted to talk a little bit first about some of the recent changes, and by recent, I mean probably about the last 8 months. As you know, we've had some false starts with some of our reorganization efforts, and about 8 months ago, we really decided that it was time to get moving on this. And the board, our state library board, who you'll hear from a little bit later, our board decided that we needed to enlist some professional help with our strategic planning process. But in the meantime, as we were moving through that process, using the information that we had gathered over the previous 3 years, we made some fairly dramatic changes that reflect the needs of the state library and the approach that we should be taking based on our funding sources. So we have ended our relationship with the Willamette Valley Genealogical Society, a private nonprofit organization. They are in the process of removing their materials. They will be, as far as I know right now, they will be moving to the Salem Public Library. And so it has actually turned out pretty well, because having them at the public library, those materials will be more available to the public. We did have some genealogy materials, and so did the Willamette Valley Genealogical Society, and we've distributed those to other libraries and organizations since we no longer offer genealogy service. And so we've had a couple of offerings, we call them offerings, of materials, and they've gone to small genealogical societies, historical societies, libraries around the state. The next thing that we've done is we've closed the reference room, and the reason that we closed the reference room is because we were staffing the reference room 35 hours a week, and we probably had one or two state agency staff members coming into the reference room probably every couple of weeks. And that room is paid for with assessment funds from agencies. So, and the other piece of it, it's not just that, but the other piece of it was that we had staff that were kind of sitting and waiting for people to come and ask them questions. And that is very much a 20th century library approach. And we really wanted to move forward with a 21st century library approach, which we are doing. And you'll see as I talk about our strategic plan.
We've also developed a new partnership with the Chemeketa Cooperative Regional Library Service that that serves all of the libraries in Yamhill, Polk, and Marion County. We are sharing a catalog with them. And we have what has happened is we will have a more robust, less expensive system than we've had in the past. And that migration is taking place right now. And we hope to have everything kind of smoothed out within the next month or so. The Oregon State Poetry Collection has been moved to the University of Oregon Libraries. The poetry collection was created a number of years ago by the previous state librarian. It was a wonderful partnership with the Oregon State Poetry Association. But again, we were using assessment funds to maintain that collection. So we've approached the University of Oregon, and again, there will be more use of it at the University of Oregon. The professors, the English professors at the U of O, are pretty excited about it, and I've seen the beautiful cases they have it in, and it's in a wonderful new home. And then the other thing that we've done is we've begun an organizational development special project with a consultant from the Chief Human Resources Officer's office. And what we're looking to do is develop a thorough performance management system. We have been, of course, doing our performance management, but really looking at it as not evaluations once a year, but performance management throughout the year. And also, because we have a very small management staff, I've also asked this consultant to help us with management, with our management skills.
Perfect. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Gnoldren. You said that you started making changes about 8 months ago when you had professional help. As I recall, the DAS has been working with you for a couple of years, and Ms. Miller has been working very closely. So what changed 8 months ago?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt. The last kind of movement in terms of the state library reorganization was in February of 2014, the short session, when there was going to be a legislative work group created, and that legislative work group has not been created. And so I felt, as the administrator of the agency, that we needed to move forward, and so everything we're doing is really kind of based in the work that we've done over the previous 3 years, the work we did with Sarah Miller, the work that we've done with the law library and the archives. So we've been doing it in the context of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Do you recall who was supposed to set up a legislative work group on the library?
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that actually was a suggestion that was set up by the co-chairs, the big co-chairs, as my partner in crime tends to refer to them. Representative Nathanson and I had done some work before, and then this was suggested, I think, in the 2014 session, but I don't actually think it was a bill. Correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Nathanson. I don't think it was a bill. It was a suggestion from the co-chairs, but I'm not sure that it actually went anywhere.
If I remember correctly, Senator, that we were under the impression that DAS and the state library and a couple legislators, along with folks from there, were all going to be getting together and working through this. That's how I remember, but I don't think it ever came to fruition.
Thank you.
Correct me, John.
Co-chairs and members of the subcommittee and Senator Whitsitt, there's a long history here, but the point of your question, the answer to your question is that effort, the initial effort in 2003 that was maybe called the second reorganization effort involving the Department of Administrative Services and the agency, was unable to produce a satisfactory report for the 14th session. There was a budget note placed in the omnibus bill suggesting the legislative work group. The co-chairs looked extensively at forming that work group, but ran out of time. But the co-chairs have continued that effort informally. So they are aware of this situation and are working on it.
Thank you.
Let's continue.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Sandra.
I went out in the hall and had a rabies shot, and I'm calming down now. So what I wanted to share with all of you, because I think it's incredibly relevant, is the fact that out of this process, as short-sighted and as lacking in common sense as I think it is, some good stuff was accomplished. You may explain to me that, Dr. Wang explained to me that as a result of their interaction with the feds, the criteria for resiliency grants has now been expanded to include Cascadia subduction. The East Coast had just pretended that the West Coast didn't exist. And so now some of our unique geological and proximity to the ocean issues have been recognized. So tsunami and Cascadia are now included in criteria. So at future bites of the apple, we may yet prevail for more communities than just the two that were named in the grant application. I think it's important for the committee to know that, and it certainly mollified my angst about this. So I just share it with you for what it's worth.
That's great. Is there a rabies vendor outside?
There is a rabies vendor outside.
See, this is why you should support the vaccination bill.
Sorry. See, I sit between two doctors, so I'm covered. I can get my rabies shot from the vet, or I can get it from the MD. So.
Oh, my God.
You prefer kill or lie.
All right, let's continue on.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. So based on the work of the stakeholders over the course, stakeholders, customers, and partners over the last 2 years, the board directed me to engage, engage someone to help us with strategic planning. We hired the Coraggio Group, which is a group of strategic planners from the Portland area, and we began with the State Library Board to develop the vision and mission of the State Library and our role of value. And you'll see that our vision is that all Oregonians have the information essential to be engaged citizens, to strengthen our communities, and to build a prosperous state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I guess I'd be curious, how much did you pay these consultants? And to me, this seems like being for peace and motherhood. One of my complaints with the State Library right straight along has been, what are the efficacious mechanics that deliver this benefit to Oregonians? And I won't go through my litany of complaints about duplication, but all of us want that. And I'm just curious how much you paid a consultancy group to tell you that that's a good thing.
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, the cost of the consultant for the course of about 6 months' worth of work was $30,000. This was the very first step, and this was a step that the board wanted to take in terms of it is pie in the sky. There's no question that it's pie in the sky. This is what we wanted to start from so that then we could work our way down to those specific things that we need to be doing to achieve this vision and the mission.
Thank you.
The State Library, our mission is that the State Library provides leadership and resources to continue growing vibrant library services for Oregonians who are print disabled, the legislature and state government, and all Oregonians through local libraries. And what we were trying to capture here is the fact that we have several constituencies. We have Oregonians via their local libraries. We have our print disabled Oregonians. And then we also have our responsibility to make sure that the state agency staff are making decisions based on evidence. So what we do that nobody else does is that we connect Oregonians to library services, we connect Oregon state government to information, and we connect Oregonians who are print disabled to reading materials through our partnership with the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. One of the things that we did throughout this process was to involve our staff. And one of the things that I think it's really important, and I'm very pleased with the core values that we have created, those came from the entire staff. We engaged everybody in the work of this. We had some very interesting discussions about what do we mean by professionalism, what do we mean by personal leadership. And so these are the things that look really good on a piece of paper, and our next step and more important step is to be able to make sure that we live these core values every day, that this is how we approach our work to the State Library. So our strategic plan is essentially for 2.5 years. It will take us through the end of the 15-17 biennium. And based on the vision, mission, role of value, and all of the input we have received over the last several years, these are the things that we must accomplish over the next 2.5 years. So teams of staff worked on each of these four strategic imperatives to identify strategies and action items that will move us forward over the next 18 months in these strategic imperatives. This is a new process for us, so it was slightly painful for the staff, but they all stepped up in an incredibly good way. And so we've identified it, in addition to identifying those strategies, we've identified the resources, including staffing, to help us carry out these strategies. And we have project teams that are carrying these, that are moving forward with these projects. So our first strategic imperative is focus on the customer. And again, these are rather high level over the next couple of years, but the strategies that we're going to be employing are developing customer service standards, defining our customer segments. We know who our customers are, but we also have, there's also been some blurring of the lines of who our customers are. So defining customer segments, identifying potential customers, and particularly assessing customer satisfaction so that we can determine our allocation of resources.
Mr. Chair, I scampered away without my computer. I don't recall whether or not you identified who those customers are, who the customer segments are.
That's part of the work that we are doing.
Oh, okay.
That's part of the work that we are doing.
Thank you.
Senator, I'm sorry.
So really quick, I do a lot of business plan development, a lot of it.
Yes.
I'm assuming for us here today, we're staying at a higher level, but, I mean, there's action items that go with these objectives, with these goals.
Co-Chair Smith, absolutely,
okay.
Absolutely. What we have, which I could bore you with, but I would prefer not to bore you with, we have an extensive tool that was provided to us by the Coraggio Group.
Perfect.
That has all of the strategic imperatives, strategies, action items, who is going to be the responsible person, all of that, and that will allow us to track it as well.
Okay, perfect. I'm going to push pause here really quick. How many folks are here to testify for the public testimony part? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, so I'm going to, you have 20 more minutes.
And I can do it.
Is that cool?
Yeah, I've just got three more imperatives.
Okay, I just want to make sure everyone has a chance to speak today.
Our next strategic imperative is build awareness of the state library. And I think one of the things that that we have been struggling with over the course of the last several years, and libraries have been struggling with over the probably last 10 or 20 years, is our libraries dying. And I'm here to tell you that libraries are not dying, but they are changing, and they need to be changing. So what we're going to be starting with is a reputation audit. In the commercial sector, that would be a brand audit. And essentially what we're going to do is we're going to find out what people, how they see us. And then we're going to refine what we do and how we tell people so that we will be able, so that people will know what it is we do at the State Library. And we will be able to increase usage of the State Library because people will know what it is we offer.
So when the reputation audit is completed, can you make sure that John gets a copy of that?
Absolutely.
I want to make sure we see that. Senator Johnson.
Respectfully, it asked the question exactly wrong, in my opinion. We're going to increase usage because they know what we offer. Going back now a biennium, I've asked, are you offering the right things? From a state technology perspective, I would hate to see us build customer base in an anachronistic delivery system. And we don't need to rehash this whole thing, but the duplication with you and the Commission for the Blind. And, I mean, you're studying how do we get more people in the door. That had been one of the complaints, that the place was empty. But are we getting them in the door for the right stuff?
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, that is absolutely why we're doing this. This is absolutely why we're doing this, is we want to know how we want to be able to add value to the people who are our customers. But if they don't know what we offer, if they have a vision that is old, if you will, or kind of nostalgic, then we won't be able to. People won't even come in the door.
If they are your customers, by definition, they're coming in the door. They're using your service.
Senator Johnson, we. I will be honest. There is a large percentage of state agency staff who don't know that the resources we provide are available. We need to provide them with that information. And I believe that's our responsibility to make sure that they know what we have to offer.
I give.
Okay, let's continue.
So our next strategic imperative is cultivate staff strengths. We have an amazingly good staff at the State Library, and they have a variety of skills and talents. And we really want to make sure that we are using them to their fullest extent. And so we will be designing a performance management system, and it provides a framework for continuous improvement and appropriate professional development, which I think is something that gets left behind oftentimes is the professional development.
Senator Johnson.
We were just having a sidebar here, and I think that it is reasonable to share with our new colleagues, Representative Hurd, Representative Taylor, and Representative Kump, who are new to this, and maybe reflecting on the quality and the nature of the questions and why it is that some of us seem a little cranky. And correct me if I'm wrong, colleagues, but we've been talking about this for 4 years. And so this is a conversation that some of us have had for a long time. And I think that the urgency is what you see reflected in our questions. It isn't just we all decided to come down here and be growl. This is an ongoing conversation that has been happening for a long time.
Let's continue.
Thank you. So our final strategic imperative is to enhance partnerships. And I think it's important to note that we are not just starting these initiatives. We are building on the work that we've done over the course of a number of years, and particularly with the enhanced partnerships. That's going to be based on and built on the partnerships that we've developed with other organizations, with other state agencies, so that we can continue to be effective and efficient and provide the services that Oregonians need to reach our vision.
So really quick, within this work plan, are you making sure you're coordinating with LFO to show us, if any, and I underline if any, mm-hmm. where there's overlap, where there's duplication of service, et cetera, to make sure that we're working together to eliminate that?
Co-Chair Smith, absolutely. The other thing that I'll be doing is, as I said, we have a tracking tool, the Excel tracking tool. But in addition to that, the board has asked me to do three times a year do a review of where we are with each of these strategic imperatives, and I can certainly share those with the LFO as well. And I think that's going to provide kind of where we are in terms of targets and issues that have come up and how we're going to deal with those issues.
So from my perspective, I think what I'm looking for is how do we ensure that Oregon has the premier state library? And how do we make sure that we don't have this duplication of service or services that simply at one time were needed but no longer are? And how do we work through all of that? And so I'm hoping when you're talking with John at LFO, you're really identifying those areas. And at the same time, identifying those opportunities that we need to be taking advantage of to make us that premier state library.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. So we have some three-year objectives, and we will need to be setting benchmarks the first year, and then we can set targets as we move forward. So we want to improve customer satisfaction, including our ability to fulfill requests with state library resources and referrals for both quality of service and product. The thing that I think it's important to remember is that we have, I believe, over the last number of years, tried to be everything to everybody. And one of the things that this is designed to do is to allow us to focus, allow us to really determine who our audience is and who we need to be serving. But what we will need to do is we'll need to be able to refer those people who have perhaps been our patrons to other resources. We're going to look at establishing a method to prioritizing services by customer segment, and that's where we come in with developing the customer segments. We want to increase awareness of the state library. I think that sounds like a very simple approach, but there, when you say library to people, oftentimes people will say, I love libraries. I went to the library as a child. But there's the understanding of what a library can offer now is very misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And so I really feel like that's a very important part of what we're going to be doing. Increase efficiency through reduction of duplication, overlap, and fragmentation. And the basis of that will be to work with, particularly to be working with the archives in the State of Oregon Law Library, but also with other libraries that we work with, other organizations, other agencies, other agency libraries, to make sure that we're not duplicating. And then developing our performance management process. And again, I want to emphasize that the performance management process is not a form to evaluate people once a year. The performance management process is to help improve the state library on an ongoing basis and to use the wonderful talents that we have in our staff on an ongoing basis as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Smith. Thank you so much for coming today. What can you just maybe off the top of your head tell us who your three biggest customers are within the state agencies or throughout the state? What would you say just off the top of your head?
Well, we have the state employees, we have our talking book customers, and then we have libraries. Uh-huh. So do you mean within those?
In general, I meet you at a cocktail party and I say, who comes and uses? What are the top three customers that take up most of the FTE's time?
Excuse me, Co-Chair Smith and Representative Taylor, I'm sorry. I would say that for our government services, the healthcare agencies use us very heavily.
Okay.
And the natural resources agencies use us as well.
Okay.
When we're talking about our library support and development, I would say that our primary audience is public libraries. The academic libraries tend not to need the assistance of the state library the way public libraries do.
Okay.
And then for our talking book and braille library, we have a very large aging population,
mm-hmm.
but we're trying to expand that into the education system as well.
Okay. I just wanted to share with my fellow committee members that I'm very biased because the state library actually is something that in the audits division in the Secretary of State's office, we use a lot, and we probably couldn't produce the quality of audits that we have produced in many circumstances without the highly skilled librarians. So sometimes when we do these complicated audits, you know, we are walking in and maybe have some base knowledge, and you know, we tried to get assigned, the auditor, state auditor Gary Blackmore will assign us, you know, trying to match people's skills level with what it is that you're going to go and look into. But we have to sometimes rely on these highly qualified librarians to help us through the research, some of the research questions, and they save us a huge amount of time because they will go and compile information for us very nicely and save us hours and hours of time. If someone asks me as a management auditor, to go figure something out, I can do it, but it probably would take me, you know, a couple of days or something to go through it, whereas some of the librarians that we're lucky enough to have across the street can do it in a matter of 3 or 4 hours and then give the information for us. And because they keep so much information from when the state was formed, one of the problems we have in government is that we keep repeating ourselves in the problems that we create. And so we can ask the state librarian, can you tell us all the times that there was a census, for example, on the boards and commission audit, one of the boards and commission audits I did, how many times did people talk about sunsetting, having sunsets for boards and commissions? And then they were able to tell us how many times people have sat around in rooms just like this and talked about that. Mm-hmm. And then we were able to say, oh, so we keep having the same conversations. And so there's a lot of information that they possess, and at least in my little professional world, that we used them and they were very valuable, and I don't think we could do the quality of work without them. But so
that's really good to know.
So
perfect. Any other questions or comments? All righty. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to move to the public part of public testimony. And Aletha, come on up. And Abigail, if you two ladies could come up and introduce yourself for the record.
Co-Chair Smith and Steiner Hayward and members of the committee, my name is Aletha Bonebreak. I am the current chair of the State Library Board of Trustees.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith and Steiner Hayward and members of the committee. I'm Abigail Elder. I'm a legislative co-chair for the Oregon Library Association, and I'm the director of the Beaverton City Library.
Yay, Beaverton. Okay. Couldn't resist, sorry.
So, Co-Chair Smith and Steiner Hayward and members of the subcommittee, I live in Baker City. And I am the retired director of the Baker County Library District, having served in that capacity for 22 years, and a founding member of the SAGE Library Consortium, currently combining the catalogs of 77 public, academic, school, and special libraries, serving 15 counties in Eastern and Central Oregon. The board is made up of 7 members appointed by the governor. We are delighted to be back up to our full complement of members as we move forward in the strategic planning process that focuses our resources intentionally on fulfilling the state library statutory charges and, in this context, providing support for evolving opportunities in technology and education to meet broad legislative goals. Yeah, I can't tell. I'm sorry. We have a diverse and knowledgeable board representing different user constituencies, library relationships, and geographical areas. Sam Hall from Salem, Ebony Bell from Portland, Susan Hathaway Markser from Portland, Jenny Tucker from Somerville in Union County, Ann Malkin from Bend, and Leslie Hicks from Independence. The State Library Board appreciates the support shown for the programs in the Governor's Balanced Budget Plan. The transformation process that the State Library has been engaged in since 2011 at the legislature's request to shed itself of activities and collections accumulated gradually since its founding over 100 years ago, and evaluate its role for the 21st century in relation to its charge and agency partnerships has informed our forward vision and planning, culminating in the strategic plan that we are currently implementing. This process was launched with professional guidance, full engagement of the board in the development of its vision and core values, and is defining the scope and implementation of the state library program supported by this budget through excellent managerial leadership and integrated staff support among its 3 organizational departments. The board is in support of the changes in the Ready to Read grant program, renamed Reading for Success, to reflect the importance of literacy skills in educational success through high school. The changes therefore expand the age group served from 0 to 17, and add the opportunity for after school or out of school programming during the school year, in addition to traditional summer reading programs. These 2 changes serve to align this very successful program with the age and programming guideline of other state library state literacy goals and the educational investments of the state, all of which have involved a broad stakeholder process. The third change is an increase in the base grant, that is to say, a minimum grant, from $1,000 to $1,200 to keep the support relevant to costs of program delivery. These base grants are for the smallest community libraries, some of which used to receive $100 to $200 or less under the formula of geography and child population, the lowest in 2006 being $51. These were at a level which cannot deliver any meaningful program. In Oregon, we make sure the children of our state receive equal opportunities in education with standard funding allocation per child and additional funds given for small rural schools to form an equitable base to support the educational environment for every child. The reasoning is the same for the minimum grants. So that every child has access to enhanced literacy programs to retain their skills during the summer slide. Some of these libraries operate with annual book budgets no larger than the program grant and would be unable to find funding for summer reading. However, with the increase in 2007 to a $1,000 minimum level impacting 50 communities, to actually make these summer reading programs meaningful, library participation rose in that year to 98.4% and last year reached 100%. Last year's grant reporting reveals that every $1 in grant funding leveraged an average of $1.87 in community support, a nearly 2-to-1 local match when the funds are granted and used. The board also supports the full funding request for the Talking Books and Braille service, which includes the return of general fund support for the Library Services Specialist 1 for the following reasons. The donation fund exists and is heavily supported by a grateful user community to provide the kind of enhancements that enrich their lives, such as the audio news line of local print media created daily, the cost of which is shared by the National Federation for the Blind, Oregon, the State Library, and the Oregon Commission for the Blind, as well as providing the League of Women's Voters pamphlet, the recording of Oregon books at the Idaho State Library, production of the specialized calendar for the vision impaired, and all of the fund development activity. Two, the fund cannot sustain support of this position, which is essential to shipping and receiving of all digital material and cleaning and circulating of all machines, a position fundamental to the actual provision of this service. Three, if the fund is used up, there would be no funds for the appeals and fund development, which is tantamount to eating one's seed corn. Four, nor would there be funds for the essential circulation services provided by this position. In the end, when we are serving only 8% of the eligible Oregon population, we have the duty to sustain the base program and build enhancements to meet new opportunities and serve new customers. The donation funds were used to save the program during the Great Recession. It is not a sustainable model. Lastly and briefly, the board is supportive of the recent changes in the structure of government information services in terms of streamlining service delivery through outreach to its customer base and training in use of tools, a proactive rather than a reactive approach. The department is reorganizing its staffing and services to the more efficient and effective just-in-time instead of just-in-case model. The board is particularly pleased with the progress made in realigning this service. The board supports the state librarian in the organizational development of the cooperative environment in the state library, working closely with labor in creating a mutually supportive single agency value system. Thank you for your kind attention. I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions for Aletha? Thank you.
Thank you.
please introduce yourself, Abigail?
Thank you. Chair Smith, Chair Steiner Hayward, and all of the committee members, thank you so much for allowing me to come and speak to you for a couple minutes today. Again, I'm Abigail Elder from Beaverton City Library and co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Library Association. There are a lot of things, big and small, that the State Library does to support public libraries, but I wanted to touch on three of them today that I feel I could not, as a public library director, do without their support. And the first one is not very glamorous. In fact, it's really boring, and that's statistics. It probably doesn't come to a, you might be shocked, actually, to learn that libraries are really funded by English majors, and we aren't big on statistics. So the State Library really has to hold our hand every step of the way when we do statistics. And they require us to do them annually for public libraries. And this has gone on for, I think, about 20 years. So we have a rich database of information and data that we can watch trends, we can compare ourselves nationally, we can compare ourselves with each other. You better know that I am watching the other libraries in Oregon, and when I see an interesting trend, I call up those directors to find out what they've been doing and how I can copy that success. They have also helped us move not just from outputs, you know, how many people came to the library and how many books they checked out, but to what does it mean for outcome? How have we changed lives? What differences are we making in the community? And the State Library has been a leader on that, not just for public libraries in Oregon, but nationally. And we're so thankful that they have led us along that way, not just so that we can have good reports and feel good about ourselves, but to our own funders, to private funders, being able to leverage those statistics and really tell our story and be accountable. Secondly, another kind of hidden thing that the State Library does for us is they negotiate and lead the process of choosing a statewide database or databases system. For example, we have a database called Learning Express, which allows people all over the state to practice exams, work on their GED, work on their ASVAB, work on their cosmetology exam, work on their commercial driver's license, all things that we as public libraries would all need to negotiate individually. We would all have to work with those vendors. We would all have to figure out what the best databases are. We have other databases for academic use, for high school students, for the general public, for consumers, for businesses, job seekers. And I know that investigating projects like that and negotiating contracts is a huge job, even for a big library like Beaverton. So smaller libraries and mid-sized libraries in the state probably would be unable to have the wide variety of databases that they have available to them if it were not for the State Library taking a lead on that. Not only do they lead the process, but they also do a great job of listening to their customers. They listen to libraries, hear what we've had on the feedback, what kind of training we might need. They've really done a great job of having a transparent process that makes sense for all of us. Finally, as Aletha talked about, reading Ready to Read has been around for over 20 years. I've been a librarian for 15 years in Oregon, so I've been able to see firsthand how Ready to Read funds have supported children in our state. And now I just realized that if you were, you know, 5 or if you were 3 years old when it started, you are now 23. We have raised a whole generation of kids in Oregon on Ready to Read. And we have some real statistics to back that up. In 1994, attendance at children's literacy programs was 488,000, but in 2013, it was 1.2 million attendees. So we've done a great job of growing growing readers in the state. We're able to leverage Ready to Read funds. As Aletha noted, that's being changed from reading Ready to Read to Reading for Success, and we really support those changes. It will expand the ages from currently, I think it's 14, it'll go up to 17 to reach that critical teenage years. It raises the minimum amount of the grant from 1,000 to 1,200, and I know libraries like Enterprise and Helix and small libraries across the state really depend on those funds and do amazing work with it. So I think an extra $200 will be stretched in incredible ways. It also prioritizes services to underserved youth, helps us try some new things, provide some new services, and allows for some flexibility that wasn't there previously. So those are just three very basic things that the State Library does every day. We know them on a first-name basis. It's such a relief to be able to call them up
Sometimes being a library director can be kind of a lonely job, so it's great to have the state library there to be that sounding board, to tell you about other people who have tried what you're trying to do, to lend that neutral ear. They're not caught up in your local politics. The staff at the state library are so approachable and knowledgeable and generous with their time, and have really helped us move forward. I think it's no secret that in Oregon we have some of the best libraries in the country, and that is definitely in part thanks to our state library. So thank you so much for your support of readers and libraries across the state, and like Aletha, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
So do we have any questions for Abigail? Thank you, ladies.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. All right, Candace and Janet, do you want to come up? Welcome. If you could just introduce yourself for the record, that'd be perfect.
I'm Candace Watkins, president of the Oregon Library Association and also library director at Clatsop Community College in Astoria, Oregon.
And I'm Janet Webster. I, along with Abigail, co-chair OLA's legislative committee, and I'm recently retired from 26 years at Oregon State University Libraries in Newport, one of those challenged neighborhoods who could also use some of that federal money.
Welcome. Go ahead.
So, co-chair Smith and Steiner Hayward and members of the committee, I want to thank you for taking some time to hear our testimony. OLA, Oregon Library Association, is an association of about 1,200 members, and we represent all libraries in Oregon, academic, school libraries, and public libraries as well. I'm here to talk a little bit about the critical role that the state library plays in literacy development, and especially the education continuum in Oregon. I'm an academic librarian, and I work closely with my other partners in education. I think 40-40-20, as we all know, has really forced educators and libraries and all types of environments to work more closely together. And at the same time, we also see the need for the development of multiple literacies, you know, not just reading proficiencies, but information literacy, digital literacy, media literacy. And we're very fortunate to have the state library because the state library links all of this work together. And I can give you a very concrete example. The Oregon School Library Standards were recently recently adopted by the State Board of Education, and these library school standards take these multiple complex literacies and embed them in the K through 12 curriculum, crossing them, matching them with the Common Core standards, so that they're very effective in the classroom. The standards were developed with LSTA grant funding that was administered by the state library. But most importantly, too, though, they were developed with the expertise and guidance of the school library consultant at the state library. So these efforts to really lead literacy development in the state, the state library plays such an important role in that. It does a number of other really important things too, but I wanted to give you one really concrete example of the role that the state library plays in that.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator Johnson.
Why was it that the state library ended up administering that grant? Are they the only pathway for the funds, or was it too complex for others, or why? How come the money funneled that way?
That's a good question. It's an LSTA grant. The organization that crafted the standards was the Oregon Association of School Libraries, which is a division of OLA. And it needed support and also guidance in creating standards that effectively spoke to the Common Core and the educational trends at the time. So it looked to the state library for guidance and funding and was successful in getting it. That's the best answer I can give you.
Follow up.
So the state library was setting the standards?
No. The state library was not setting the standards. The OASL, which is the School Library Association, crafted the standards.
Okay, I guess I'll take this outside. I've just gotten lost in all the acronyms, and I don't understand the pathway.
I can try to explain it a bit further.
I don't want to cut into the other's testimony.
Let's do this. We've got about 8 minutes left, and I have one more citizen to testify. So if you could take 2 more minutes, I'm going to give 3 for our final person.
Janet Webster from Newport, Oregon. One thing I would add is the Oregon Library Association and its associated divisions, we are all volunteers, and that's one reason why we look to the State Library for some of that professional guidance. Yesterday, in testimony from Lisa Pearson to this committee from DAS, that she had a goal up on her slides that Oregonians are equipped with the knowledge and skills for rewarding careers. It's a great goal. It's one that we all would like to do. The only way that people can do that is if they're literate. And literacy is such a basic skill. Candace mentioned the different types of literacy. You should be literate across everything these days. But reading is the core for it all. Reading skills are best learned early and practiced steadily. The Ready to Read and now going to be the Reading for Success grants have been a fabulous mechanism for really providing opportunities in all of the local communities in Oregon for just introducing kids to read, mm-hmm. propelling them through summers where they're kind of bored, 10-year-olds driving their parents crazy, but just making them so... We have literate voters that when I was at Oregon State, actually had students who could come in and maybe could do a little research that weren't just completely just Googling it, but could actually read material and begin to be able to go from that board book to the chapter book to reading complex material to be able to read scientific articles. We have that continuum, and the Ready to Read program has been the core of that support. I would say I think the expansion to 17-year-olds is great because now when we were focused so much on early literacy, we kind of have that down. We know how to do what the best practices are. We know how to do that. Now we're really looking a lot at that achievement gap that exists in different neighborhoods with different socioeconomic classes and geographic classes. We look at the problem with the summer gap. And what's left. So what can libraries do there beyond what they're already doing? How can we new partnerships that might happen? So I would just say that program is great. I would like to say that it should be $1 per kid. Mm-hmm. It used to be. We're now at 94 cents, and we'll probably go down to 85 cents with the expansion, even with the increased money. So my last fee is always $1 per kid would be even better.
Dr. Johnson.
Thank you very much for testifying, Ms. Webster. I asked this question yesterday, and I think you might be uniquely able to respond to it. What would you think about making whatever the amount is, whether it's 94 cents or a buck or $2, a challenge grant and matchable by the communities where the libraries are as an incentive to engage people around the library to get them to own part of the franchise? Do you think that's achievable?
I think most of the communities are already doing that. If you look at how they currently leverage, and I think Mary Kay mentioned, and in the annual report, $1 Ready to Read is leveraged by almost $2 across the state. Now, that's not consistent to every community. And Multnomah County has a huge fundraising mechanism and probably matches that. I think it's good to push libraries to think about how to partner and how to leverage that money. The mechanism for how you do it would be challenging. Isn't a challenge grant. Some communities I think would have a harder time. You mentioned Napa yesterday, and we have fabulous small rural communities who are aces at fundraising.
All right.
so
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate this. So I'm going to ask Christy if you could come back clean up. Welcome. If you could just share your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Christy Joachim.
I'm a licensed massage therapist. I'm a patron of the Talking Book and Braille Library Service, and I'm also the chair of the advisory council for Talking Book. And I've been a patron since 2001 when I became print disabled. So when I was asked to come here today, I was asked to testify about what it has meant to me personally. Since I am still working, Talking Books has allowed me to read the material that I need to read in order to continue my license, since I need continuing education. So that's been a big benefit for me. But I think the biggest benefit is that I've always been a big reader, and when I was no longer able to just sit down in my Barca lounger and open up a book, it was a big loss in my life. And so Talking Books has enabled me to be resilient and to stay connected to the world. And that is something that is hard to overestimate until you are in that situation. So I am able to get magazines so I can stay current. I'm able to get books, of course, a lot of recreational reading. I have found that I can get the books that I want for my particular spiritual path. And it's just, the service is just incredible. It comes to your door. They give you the reader that plays the cassettes. It's very easy to use. It comes automatically. You return the books, you get another book. The magazines, you get the magazine, you read it, you return it, you get another magazine. I get health newsletters, which helps me in my work with my clients. So, you know, it's just about the easiest, best way for people who are print disabled in whatever way to be able to stay connected with their surroundings, with the world, and, you know, to stay up with their friends. When my friends want to discuss a book, chances are I'm the one that says, let's read this book because it's been so great. I've loved it. So I just want to say that this, although the disabled population in the state of Oregon is obviously a minority population, and that's the way we want it, we are a significant population, and every minute someone is becoming eligible for the Talking Book service. So to fund the library, to continue the Talking Books, is very important because there's a whole demographic out there that either doesn't know about what the services that are provided or is going to become eligible just by virtue of being on Earth at this point.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Thank Johnson.
You. Thank you. Your testimony was very helpful to me because you've given me a perspective that I hadn't heretofore contemplated. And my question to you is this. When you're doing professional continuing ed, for example, do you call the library and ask to have a particular volume read so that you then can get it back in the Talking Books? Or are these publications generally available in some catalog that is accessible over the internet or through other sources? Do you specifically request items that are then converted to the spoken word?
I actually have not done that. I've been able to find something that the regulatory, the massage board will agree that is something that I can read and write a report on. So there's an... some hours can be books, and some hours must be practicum, you know, practical hours and lecture and that sort of thing. And when there's lecture, there's usually a book with the class. And then if I can, sometimes they're in a fairly decent print, and I have a device called an Optelect, which is like a CCTV, and it's got a huge screen like this, and there's a... magnifying thing underneath. Mm-hmm. I don't know the technical terms.
You're doing fine.
But anyway, there's a thing, and you put your book under there, and you can get it, like, huge, mm-hmm. humongous. And so that would be the other way I could look at it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you very much for testifying. Is there anyone else that did not sign up that wants to testify? I want to make sure everyone has an opportunity to be heard. All right. Seeing no other folks out there that want to testify, we're going to close the public hearing. And we're going to wish everyone a great day.
Co-chairs, there's a couple things to note. For out on OLIS are the departments are some responses to questions from yesterday from the department. But there are some issues with those responses that we're working through with the agency through. So they will be updated. So
perfect. I cut you off. I apologize. Madam Co-Chair, is there any other things you want to share? Perfect. Julie, we good? All right. We're going to adjourn for the day. All right. We're going to adjourn for the day.